Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here with Stone Payton, another episode of Atlanta Business Radio, where we spotlight Atlanta's finest businesses. How you doing, Stone?
I am doing really well and looking forward to the weekend because my youngest, who now is a waitress at J. Christopher's, she passed the menu test. She gets to actually wait on tables. And so for my belated birthday celebration, have I mentioned my birthday this week?
Not in 24 hours.
My birthday was Tuesday at the Big 5-0. So for belated birthday celebration, we are the other three of us, Katie, me, and Holly. We're going to J. Christopher, and Kelly's going to wait on us. That's what's on my mind right now.
And I, too, am thinking about restaurants because my favorite Italian restaurant, Buckhead Italian Market, is now open for the first time since February. They remodeled, and they are finally open again.
So are we going to get a chance to go see Marcello
soon? I am shooting for lunch.
Awesome. All right. But before that, we have a very exciting show today on Atlanta Business Radio. A little bit later in the program, we're going to get a chance to visit with Andrew McCaskill with William Mills Agency. And we're going to visit with Constance Dierks. Am I saying that right, Constance?
Yes,
I'm getting
a nod
from Constance.
Yeah, good job.
And Tim Duff with Next Generation Lighting. But first up on Atlanta Business Radio this morning, it is my distinct pleasure to introduce from Build Your EMR, Mr. Mike Jenkins. Welcome to the show, man.
Well, thank you, and happy birthday.
Thank you. So EMR, what does it stand for, and what are you guys out there trying to do for folks?
So we are a company, we build electronic medical record software for physicians, for typically the doctors in the smaller clinics, your primary care physicians. EMR software takes the paper chart and makes it electronic.
Now, are doctors still using paper charts? Like, what percentage of doctors are still using paper?
Quite a few. I think the latest numbers are about somewhere between 40% and 50% are still on paper.
Oh, so they're still hanging on there.
Yes, they are.
Now, hasn't there been some government incentives to get them to switch?
There have. So in 2009, the stimulus bill created, they set aside $19 billion to help.
To encourage them to go digital.
Yes, they did. And they've spent quite a bit of that. But even that much money set aside, there's still half the doctors in the nation are still on paper.
So it's not a rule. It's not a law. You don't have to do it, but you're strongly incented to do it. And if you're smart, you should be doing it. Is that the Mike Jenkins position on this?
That absolutely. every doctor should be doing this. And there are advantages, immediate advantages, and there's certainly long-term advantages to the overall healthcare program.
So what are some of the advantages?
Well, first of all, we've all been to one doctor, and in the next week we go to someplace else.
Right.
And we have to fill out
the same form.
And you have to, that information from one place is not shared with another.
And it could be like if you're in like a hospital, it could be like one department and another department sometimes. It seems like it's so cumbersome.
Sometimes. Most of the larger hospitals are
have already made the switch,
but the smaller ones are still, you know, catching up.
Mm-hmm.
But not all of these implementations, these EMR implementations are going well and smooth and on time and on budget. Is that accurate? And if so, why not?
It's very accurate. So when the stimulus bill was passed and this money, the carrot was dangled, a lot of companies started up in the EMR business. You know, we're very much a red ocean right now. There's 3,000 vendors that are certified in stage one to provide EMRs.
So you have to be certified. Like you can't just say, yeah, I'll do that for you because I'm a good typist and I'll transfer this stuff.
In order to qualify for federal funding, you had to have gotten your EMR system certified through the ONC. And there was a set of rules in 2011 that all the vendors had to follow. They were fairly easy.
Mm-hmm.
There's a new set now in 2014. So starting January 1st, anyone who wants to attest for federal money must get certified on a 2014 certified electronic medical record.
And that's to weed out some of the...
The bar has been raised quite a bit, actually. And in mid-July, I ran a report. There were 3,800 certified 2011 systems.
Right.
52 certified 2014 systems.
So what's your backstory? How did you get in this line of work? Because I don't want to embarrass you, but you came before EMR. So you were doing something else before EMR.
Oh, wow. I've pretty much tried a little bit of everything. My background, I started with working with the Navy, building weapons systems, and then went from there to computer-based training, worked in the aviation world, went in telecommunications. You know, as my six-year-old said once upon a time, I couldn't keep a job.
So is it a franchise or something you built personally? Or yeah, walk us through that a little bit.
I am... A past job, I built a professional services group to do software consulting for hospitals. And one of the guys that worked for me left and started this company about 4 years ago. And he's built it up. He's got a pretty substantial base of physicians using the product. And he called me. This thing started a few years back. He said, you know, it's time for us to expand. Will you come help me grow the business?
Because you had already worked together.
We had.
And then so you're like, you saw that there's a lot of opportunity here, so you decided to join forces?
That's correct. So I had worked with Dr. Jindal in the past. He's one of the most
brilliant
people
doctor.
I know.
He's used this stuff, so he knows where the benefits are.
Right. And we built a system to work the way doctors work.
Yeah. Right. Instead of just some technician building it the way that a technical person would like it to work, you made it work like a doctor would like it.
So that's really the magic sauce with our product. Uh-huh. You know, unlike most of the systems, the EMR systems were put together very quickly to get federal funding based on the 2009 requirements. We actually sat down and built a system that works the way doctors work. You know, one guy described us as exquisitely configurable. So our product, after a couple of days of configuration, looks just like the paper chart you used the day before.
Wow.
Electronically, all the fields and the forms are in the same spot. We use your language, your workflow. So
you customize it to the doctors?
We do.
Their workflow? Now, you mentioned earlier that there were like 3,800 EMR companies that were 2011 certified and only 52 2014 certified. Are you guys one of the 52?
We are. Proud to say that.
Congratulations.
We completed the 2014 certification.
So you're ahead of the game.
Yes.
Now, does this apply to, I don't know, dental offices and other kinds of offices as well? Or are there only specific kinds of physician practices? Or do they all need and want this kind of thing?
It mostly applies to offices that accept Medicare and Medicaid.
Aha. Mm-hmm. So that's what's important. So walk us through an engagement, if you will. So the Lee and Stone Physicians Clinic that takes...
Dr. Stone.
Dr. Stone's Medical Clinic.
Great question.
We reach out. How does it work? We sit down and we talk. Walk us through that engagement, if you would.
Well, there's a couple of parts to this. We spend a couple of days talking to you about how you run your practice. So every practice is run different. You know, so when you go to your doctor, you know, the first thing you do is you get checked in at the front desk.
You sign that little...
Well, you sign the HIPAA agreement.
That I won't sue you no matter what.
Checked in at the front desk, and then you sit in the waiting room for a while, and then they take you in the back, and they do your vitals, and then they put you in a room, and you wait a little while longer, and the doctor comes along, and they fill out a paper, and you know, you spend 5 minutes with the doctor, and they write a prescription, and you leave, and then somebody gets billed for that.
Right.
We take that whole process, you know, and each clinic does it differently. In a lot of cases, different doctors within the same clinic will do that.
They have different procedures? Really?
They absolutely do. And we customize or reconfigure our system based on each one of their needs. So the day they go from paper to electronic or they go from an old electronic to new electronic, the system works the way they worked the day before. So there's a very small learning curve. So within, I'd say, less than a week usually, we have them up and running on their forms, their workflows, their process, their language, and then we teach them how to customize it themselves. So over time, they start realizing that there are better ways to do some of this. There's better ways to write it, better ways to...
So they can get the most out of it.
Yes.
Right.
And they make their own configuration changes, and they do it, you know, in seconds most of the time at no additional cost.
Now, do you help them with that? Is there a support element from your firm that helps them kind of learn the best practices or learn, like, different ways of doing things? Or do you
there's kind of two questions there. We don't presume to know their business better than they do. So, no, we don't tell them there are workflow changes you can make. We will help them if they have them and want them. but we don't really say, you know, best practices are X because it's unique for
everybody. Everybody has their own way of doing it.
But as far as supporting the product, you know, our goal, we're growing. We're an expanding company, and we want as many solid, reputable customers as we can get. So we're going to bend over backwards to
now,
make them succeed.
Now, are your doctors who use your system, are they coming from paper to your system, or are they coming from a not-so-great EMR to your system?
Both. Mm-hmm. We had one of our early customers was on his third EMR. He had just spent...
Third EMR.
So
he's gone through the whole 3,800, right?
No, this was before that. He had just spent $250,000 to install and use an EMR. He used it for a week, pulled the plug. He said, I hate this thing.
In a week?
And we walked in, you know, during that week and said, hey, we've got a product. He's like...
Didn't even want to deal with it, right? I wouldn't want to. If I just dropped that kind of money, it would be hard to convince me to try something else.
Well, it kind of put us in his crosshairs. He's like, all right, you know, if you want to prove, if you want to walk the talk, I'll give you a shot, you know, but you're going to do things my way.
Uh-huh.
And our system was able to do that. And
wow.
He is now one of our best.
That's a great testimonial. I'd send all my prospects to him.
Right.
Yes. He's also he's one of the kind of the architects. You know, a lot of our things that we do now will bounce off him first. It's like, hey, what do you think of this?
Oh, so you've kind of created this custom client board where they're helping you shape the product. And
absolutely.
So that's important because I guess being founded by a doctor, mm-hmm. it's important to get the doctor's perspective in all this.
Well, right. So everything we do is intended to make the doctor's job easier. So, for example, we helped the Missouri Cancer Registry. They were the first.
Because they're the show me state, so they want you to show them.
Well, they were the first registry in the country to accept cancer tumor reports directly from a physician, and we helped them do that. There's another state that's accepting reports, but they're doing it through a health information exchange, which we can also support. But our approach to that was to build a tool that the doctor could click one button and that report was gone. So instead of spending steps to save it to here and copy it and stick it in an email and do all these things, one button, job's done.
So I want to go to the sales and marketing side of this thing because I'm trying to envision myself as a salesperson with some experience and success selling intangible stuff in the past. But calling on doctors, how do you even get in the door to have these kinds of conversations with the people that you need to talk to?
Well, it's mostly networking through other companies that have relationship with doctors. A lot of our partners are billing companies, practice management software companies, and things like that. The door-to-door approach is almost impossible.
I'll bet.
The gatekeepers
are
just
like,
too good.
And there's laws, right? You can't just knock on doors and bring them lunch. Like at one point, pharmaceutical reps could come in and...
Correct.
And that you can't do that anymore, right?
We can't do that, and I don't, you know, we're not big enough to afford that kind of sales approach anyway. But the product speaks for itself, and we've got a new product or new component in our product that we launched this week. It's called SmartSheet 10, and this is another instance of kind of the government pushing things into
encouraging.
The business.
They're encouraging, you know, trying to help.
It will. I believe, you know, the entire stimulus program, meaningful use is what it was called, is actually working. You know, all of these doctors are going digital, and mm-hmm. ultimately that's going to benefit the patient and the doctors and everyone. But it's going to take some time to get us there. ICD-10 is another challenge that everyone's facing now. Doctors have been, if you go to your primary care physician, you have a physical or you have a cold, and they, when you walk out, you give them a check for your copay, and they hand you a piece of paper with a bunch of numbers on it.
Right.
Those numbers are ICD-9 codes. Those are the numbers that get sent back to your insurance company, and every one of those represents a dollar amount that gets sent to the doctor. There are about 17,000 of those. ICD-10 takes that from 17,000 to 68,000 with, you know, and sometimes up to 15 variations of each one of those.
Wow.
And it is a... You know, it's an absolute mandatory process that starts on October 1st of 2014. If you're billing ICD-9 on September 30th, on October 1st, every doctor in this country will be billing on ICD-10 if they want to continue to get paid. There's a huge learning curve. It's got the physicians are sort of just...
Well, the number, just the sheer number increase has just got to be overwhelming.
And the structure of it all changes.
Mm-hmm.
So we have built into our product a set of tools that it does several things. One, it allows you to very quickly and easily look up the codes on both sides. There's a product called GEMS, the General Equivalence Mapping, that's been published by CMS, Center for Medicare, and we've incorporated GEMS. So you can take the ICD-9 cheat sheet that you use today, and most doctors have, you know, 20 or 30 of those codes
right.
that they use 90%
regularly,
of the
right.
time. Run that cheat sheet through this GEMS crosswalk, and it will, you know, within 3 seconds, it'll generate an ICD-10 style
like
cheat
the translation
sheet.
To what the ICD-10
yes.
numbers are.
The problem there is there's not a one-to-one translation. You know,
oh, so there's some nuance.
Very
there
much.
Has to go from much. What just a few thousand to 68,000.
Yes. Yeah. So some of the crazy ICD-10 codes, there's actually a code now for getting sucked into a jet engine.
So we're ready for that in case it happens.
Yes.
So you talked about, actually you used the phrase red ocean earlier in the conversation, and I don't know, some of the sharks out there in this red ocean are providing EMR systems for free, but this is not my first rodeo. There's got to be some sort of cost.
Nothing's free.
That's
talk
right.
to us about the cost of free from your perspective.
Well, there is cost and there's price. So the price is zero. You can have the system. You can go online today and sign up at zero cost and have a system that is functional. The problem is the cost over the long term is much higher because it's not configurable. It forces doctors to do things their way. And there
right.
are some that, you know, you see that zero price tag and they're just
right.
you know, all over it. But in the long term, it's costing them more in terms of time. It's costing them in terms of quality. It's costing them in terms of capability. You know, where if they spent a few more dollars up front, they would have a system that ultimately made money for them or saved time, you know, which time is money in the healthcare
right.
business.
So it might, in the short term, it might seem like it's costing nothing, but in the long term, it could be costing a fortune in time
right.
and resources that have to deal with it.
Well, there are some systems, some doctor friends of mine that claim they're spending anywhere from 2 to 4 hours a day updating charts that they didn't have to do when they were on paper, you know, that
which is absurd because this yeah. is supposed to make things easier and faster.
Correct. And to me, that's a pay cut. I mean, that's
right.
a huge
you're,
pay
you're
cut.
Losing money with your free.
That's right.
right.
And what about this meaningful use thing? You mentioned that briefly a little while ago as well. And Lee, I think when we talked to the folks over at Acer 2 Solutions, they were talking about meaningful use.
Meaningful use.
Yeah. Speak to that a little bit, if you would.
So the point of the stimulus money set aside, it's called the High Tech Act. The point of that is to first, there's three stages that we're aware of. First stage is just to get doctors off of paper onto electronic.
Right.
Stage two starts this year in 2014. And that's going to be to get doctors and patients to start sharing information with each other. And stage three will more than likely, we don't really know what stage three is yet, it's being defined, but it'll more than likely be having doctors and other doctors share information. It'll be using all of that health information in a more meaningful way. So, you know, imagine if instead of having to, you know, if I got a referral to a specialist, you know, having to fax my information over, that the data was there before I arrived. You know,
imagine a world where that could happen.
Yes. And meaningful use, I know a lot of people, a lot of doctors are saying this is just another way for the federal government to, you know, deny claims. And if done wrong, that is true. ICD-10 and all of these programs can be done that way. But I'm actually impressed with the fact that meaningful use, the stage two, the 2014 requirements have what have historically been extremely closed systems. They're already sharing information with each other. You know, there are the big EMR vendors, you know, the $300 million implementation vendors are writing press releases about how great they are because they can share this information. Well, the reality is anyone who has a 2014 certified system will be able to share the same
right.
information.
So that information will be aggregated?
Right. It will be. And,
now,
and the real story is meaningful use. It's not these two companies working together.
Right. It's all the companies working together. But when you have that type of sharing of information, I know privacy is an important element to all of this too. And you got to protect the individual's privacy. And don't you have some issues with, I'm a doctor and I have a vendor that I'm sharing information, maybe lab tests or even mm-hmm. credit card information that I got to kind of lock down my security as well.
Well, those rules are in place today. You know, the doctor can't send my chart to another doctor without my permission.
Mm-hmm.
And all we're doing is just making that electronically enforceable.
And then your system helps them stay compliant with that? Or
it
helps protect the privacy every step of the way, right?
Yes.
So if you would, as we wrap, sort of paint the picture what it can mean for a physician's practice, financial impact, quality of life, peace of mind, if they work with an organization like yours and put EMR in place and do it right, because it's got to have a strong positive financial impact, and it's got to make just life and living a lot more fun, I would think.
It does. Most of our doctors who have spent a little bit of time setting up our system to work their way get to go home on time. They get to spend more time with patients. One of them has actually bragged that his patients are saying that I get more face-to-face time now with you on electronic than I did when you had your head burying the clipboard. So they're pretty happy about it. And the system is constantly evolving. You know, we're already up to speed on the 2014 requirements. We've added this ICD-10 mm-hmm. smart sheets. We're evolving all the time based on feedback from our current doctors and users.
What a concept, a business that listens to their clients and then builds a product that serves their needs.
I like
That's
it.
Brilliant.
Thank you.
So where can our listeners, and particularly our medical practice listeners, go to learn more and have a conversation with you guys about this?
Well, it all starts with our website, www.buildyouremr.com. All one word. And we're also on Twitter, Build Your EMR, and I'm the technology chef.
All right.
There you go.
Well, thanks so much for coming down to visit with us. We got to have you back. Maybe come back with a
Yeah, bring that doctor
sometime.
That loves
Thank
you so much.
Thank you. Well, I would love to.
I think that would be fun. Get it for right. You'd be up for that, maybe?
That,
I think that
would
be a lot of fun. All right. How about hanging out with us while we visit with our next guest?
I'm looking forward to it.
Terrific. Next up on Atlanta Business Radio, we have with us from William Mills Agency, Mr. Andrew McCaskill, APR, which I'll bet is some sort of professional designation, probably has a great many talents, not the least of which is helping organizations manage what might be initially perceived as a crisis. But I bet you're able to reframe that for everybody in a hurry, aren't you, Andrew?
I think I could. APR is something I'm very proud of. I am accredited in public relations. Only a handful of folks have gotten that designation. It took me about 15 years to get there, and it is an achievement that comes from our professional organization, the Public Relations Society of America, and it's based on a lot of testing, and you have to present to a panel of your peers and take a four-hour test, and it's all about ethics and best practices in managing public relations and communications for companies, whether they be big or small. So, I mean, I am pretty proud of the APR designation, actually. So
now PR is kind of evolving with the advent of social media. I have a degree in advertising from way long ago.
Yeah. We know.
Way long ago.
He slides that in every broadcast, just like I did the birthday thing.
Yeah.
So advertising.
Happy birthday, by the way.
Yeah.
He's just milking this.
Too late.
So advertising at one point was kind of the driver of how companies interacted with their clients in a lot of ways. And PR was like, oh, in case something terrible happens, or send out press releases to announce something. But now it seems like PR is in the driver's seat because of the advent of social media and the back and forth dialogue with customers that's happening more. Are you seeing that?
Absolutely. I mean, engagement is really what you want with your customers, whether your customers are other businesses or your customers are consumers. So, you know, the public relations function and communications function really is in the driver's seat much more so than advertising has been in the past, because I feel like that, you know, advertising, of course, you can control the message and that sort of thing, but there's no cheaper, faster way of managing your message and getting your getting awareness out there than public relations. Because the beauty of public relations and the beauty of, you know, having, you know, your product or your company being, you know, talked about in editorial is that there's also sort of an implied endorsement of the publication. There's an implied endorsement, particularly in my world, which is the B2B world, we work with companies like your previous guest's company. So I'm going to be giving him my business card before we leave out of here today. And you know, in my firm, William Mills Agency, is we specialize in public relations in highly regulated industries. So we have a healthcare practice. We have a technology practice. I mostly manage companies in our banking and technology practice. So you know, for us, our clients do everything from the software that powers internet banking to those companies that put mobile banking apps on smartphones and tablets. So we provide, so our clients all provide services to financial services companies or and mostly technologies and technology solutions. So
what are some of the major mistakes or common patterns of things that are not being done, going undone in companies that don't have the benefit of counsel from somebody like you, both in general and in crisis? What are some of the mistakes you see over and over?
Well, crisis, and I run the crisis practice at my firm.
Okay, so that's your wheelhouse.
So that's
so you're good with chaos. Good, like, you have to have certain skills, you know, right?
Yeah. I'm hanging on to his card.
Yeah. you know, honestly, I think that, you know, one of the things that happens with companies in a crisis situation is a lot of companies try to go it alone. You know, in most situations, at the first sign of trouble, if there was a legal issue, you'd immediately go to your general counsel and you'd talk to the in-house attorneys and say, you know, here's exactly what happened. It would be full disclosure, you know, and if the general counsel didn't have the right experience, they would say, okay, well, we're going to go out and hire the specialist firm that can help us make the, you know, make the right decision. Unfortunately, for a lot of companies, a lot of senior executives feel like that they're going to go it alone in the court of public opinion, which is crazy to me.
Well, in today's world, whether you want to deal with it or not, the public's going to deal with it because they're going to have a say-so because they're going to be all over their Facebook page and Twitter, and they're going to have their own opinion. And that genie's out of the bottle, right?
You can't. Absolutely.
They're going to say whatever they want to say, so you better get ahead of it.
You've got to get ahead of it, and you've got to be really, really smart and strategic about it, and you've got to hire an expert, I think, which is another thing that the mistake that people make is that they think, oh, I'll just manage this, or I will, you know, figure it out, or, you know, I'll get the PR guy to spin it on the back end. But we live
like you're this magician, right?
Yeah.
You're going to like, oh,
I'm going to pull
out
the magic PR wand and change.
Andrew's on the job. Yeah. Relax. So he'll just make the media say whatever we want them to say.
Yeah, which doesn't happen. I mean, if you think about it, you know, probably the last major news stories that we all heard that were major world or national news, most of us didn't see it on CNN first. We probably heard about it on social media and Twitter, and then we saw it on our Twitter feed. We saw it on our Facebook feed. Then we went to CNN, or then we went to
kind of validate it. Yeah,
but
exactly.
We heard it first on social media.
Yeah. Now, let's take hypothetically this Paula Deen situation.
Sure.
She
you got to get off Paula, man. Paula's my girl.
Poor Paula.
Why are we getting on Paula?
Well, just play out the scenario with her. So, you know, she said something back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
And then she was in a deposition. So then she had to speak the truth, right? Because this is a legal situation.
Absolutely.
Here. That gets leaked, right? Because that was private, right? That wasn't public information. That was a deposition.
Well, a lot of court filings
are public?
Information.
So,
yeah, and it can appear on the internet very quickly, very easily.
So now, okay, it bubbles up. She says things that she's not proud of.
Yeah.
And now it's out there.
Right.
So now what does she do?
So I think the biggest mistake that the Deen camp made was that they, you know, one, didn't consider the fact that you need to tell the truth, tell it early, tell it yourself, you know, and, you know, sort of tell the whole truth and then, you know, get out of the way of your story. I think it's a perfect situation where you listen to just the lawyers and you don't think about reputation management,
right?
And you may win a $1.2 million lawsuit, but you lose $16 million in endorsements and partnerships.
Food Network career is out the window.
You know, I mean, if you listen to what the Food Network said about when they dropped Paula Deen, they didn't say that they dropped Paula Deen because of what she said per se. They dropped her because of how horribly her and her team handled the PR fallout.
Right.
That's their exact quote in what is. I think reputation management really is a business function. It really is an operations function. I mean, senior leaders have to think about reputation management in a way that they've never thought about it previously. It is a business function, and it is super important what you say, how you say it. That's why you need either a trained corporate communications or a trained communications professional on your team, just like you have legal counsel. And senior leaders need to be media trained. They need to be crisis trained a couple times a year, because you never know what's going
to
happen.
It seems like in her case, she was trying to be kind of proactive individually. She's like, I'll throw up some YouTube apologies that were clumsy, and then like took it down and then did it again. I mean, it was just like she made a bad situation worse. And, you know, the first rule of a bad situation, you know, when you're in a hole, you stop digging. It seemed like she kept digging.
She kept digging. And I think that that's the other – that really is the other thing about it is – that's why you go out and you hire a professional to help you figure out exactly what you need to do. Because, you know, throwing up your own YouTube, you sort of expect that sort of amateur approach from someone who's not managing a multi-million dollar business. But, you know, Paula Deen's not, you know, not in a vacuum. I think there's a lot that business leaders can learn from Paula Deen, because, you know, the CEO of BP, you know, I wonder if that guy ever got his life back. You know what I mean? He goes on TV and, like, you know, there's this oil all over the entire Gulf of Mexico, and he's like, I just want to get my life back. And
you wouldn't have coached that up in that messaging.
I would advise against that messaging, yes, absolutely.
So this is your specialty. Mm-hmm. This kind of thing happens enough to keep you and your team busy. I'm a little bit.
There's a lot of job security.
Yeah.
This happens that often. And do you have people on retainer, or you just have the bat phone, or how does that work?
It really is both. I mean, a lot of crisis management and a lot of crisis communication work is being really proactive and, you know, having a plan in place for, I mean, if you're a company that has, you know, consumer data on your, you know, on your servers, then you probably should have a crisis communications plan. You know, there are some things that you have to do by law that are disclosures that you have to make. And so you need to have a plan in place for, you know, what are the worst case scenarios. You should never be in a situation, and this is what I tell clients, you should never be in a situation where your worst case scenario, you're figuring it out
on the
while it's happening, exactly. Right? So, you know, a lot of the work that we do, we come in and, you know, we deal with clients that are in highly regulated industries, or that clients that deal with consumer data, or that, you know, have, you know, there are a number of things that could potentially go wrong. And, you know, we drill them, you know, we do a fire drill for them. So if, you know, if this happens in, you know, I think a lot of times, you know, senior business managers feel like PR and communications is the soft skill stuff until a factory blows up or until a YouTube video goes viral, right? And so what we do is we take clients through those drills before they happen so that they have some level of preparedness and for crisis preparedness. But then we also jump in. So a lot of the times when, you know, our goal is to make sure that you don't hear about a story that happens, or that we minimize, you know, the coverage of a story. And oftentimes the biggest, you know, obstacle in that is making sure that we get the truth out early so there's no big find for, you know, for media folks later.
Now, on the Paula Deen situation, she was going through a lawsuit about this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Like, this shouldn't have been news to her that this information like this wasn't something that she should have been shocked that at some point this might come out, right? This lawsuit had been going on for quite some time.
Yeah.
So how would you have, like, if you're her PR person in this situation, I know in hindsight's 20/20, but how would you have maybe kind of made it less painful for her when you knew that something like this had a high probability of coming out? Like, in your fire drill, I'm sure you would have covered this.
Absolutely.
Right?
You know, so a couple of things that we would have done was, one, we wouldn't have bailed on Matt Lauer on the Today Show, first of all, because when you don't show up for the news, it becomes news.
That becomes news, right?
I think, you know, people love a comeback kid. People love a repentant, you know, person who's made a mistake and they say, hey, look, this was a long time ago. Let me put it in some context for you. Let me tell you exactly what I did, that sort of thing. I think that, you know, a couple of things that she did right was she did a taped message or whatever, but, you know, she looked horrible in the tape. I mean, this is a woman who has her own television show, and she looked horrible. She looked tired. You know, it was a wreck. It was a whole train wreck. But, you know, I think that what she should have done was she should have been really transparent about, you know, this lawsuit actually isn't about me. This lawsuit is actually about my brother. And she should have been honest about that, you know, and talked about that, done a very short interview. And I think that she should have had some proof points and some statistics. I feel like that when your reputation is in question or your integrity is in question, you lead with statistics and you lead with facts. You don't lead with the warm fuzzies. You talk about the fact that how many people of color perhaps maybe that she had in her employ, how many jobs that she's, you know, given to people, and, you know, how many employees that she has. You know, the fact that this was the only time that there's ever been a lawsuit like this filed against her, and it's not a discrimination suit that about with a ton of people. It's one person. And I think that, you know, you lead with the facts when there's a reputation issue. And she didn't do that. She sort of, you know, like I said, she bailed on Matt Lauer. I think that probably what I would have also done is I would also not done a Today Show interview. I would have done an interview from, you know, the local station in Savannah where everybody loves her and she's the queen, and, you know, have a really softball kind of interviewer give her the interview and let every major network stream that one interview. And then I would have her go take a break for a little while and let the court case play out, you know. But she didn't call me. Call me, Paula.
Do you think it's too late for her?
Absolutely not. I'm of the opinion that if you know, if Mike Vick can come back and get his sports endorsements, then, you know, then she can come back
because her books are still selling. There's an audience for her material.
I mean, I don't want to, you know, undersell the hit that Paula Deen took. She had 12 major sponsors and her book deal all, you know.
And her TV show.
And her TV show.
A bunch. I don't think she had just one TV show in there.
Yeah, they're all gone. You know what I mean? But I do think that, you know, Martha Stewart has a TV show on now. She's still got her magazine,
network, right?
and you know, she actually went to jail. And you know, there are a lot of people that don't even remember that she went to jail.
Right. You know? No, I think it helped her in the long run. You know, it softened her image.
She took a break, you know, it softened her image, and you know, she's back doing spots on the Today Show.
She lost
weight. Yeah. Hey, that sometimes helps. Yeah. You know? So I think, is it over for Paula Deen? Absolutely not. But I think that what she should probably do is go away, you know, take a little vacation.
Right. And absence then, makes the heart grow fonder.
Absolutely.
Right?
And then maybe go do something really nice for some minority groups.
That might start a cooking school.
Write a couple checks, you know. Yeah.
So what I'm taking from this is that you need all three of those things in place. You need that. To me, it's like a hurricane evacuation plan. You need that in place. And it's not all about standing up in front of the microphones and when you get the tough question, saying, okay, Andrew, you want to field that? It's not about that. It's having the internal, it's having the external expertise to counsel. But then we've got to have capability transfer. You've got to have people on staff that can rise to the occasion and take advantage of that counsel and be prepared. You need all three of those things, don't you?
Absolutely. You should have people that are inside your enterprise that are trained to help you out with those things. And, you know, everybody thinks about crisis. In a crisis, you know, what is the media going to say? What is the media going to say? What is our spokesperson going to say on the news? But your audiences and your stakeholders are not just the media. You know, your audiences and your stakeholders are your employees. What do you say to your employees? How do you communicate to them? You know, that's your first line of contact. And you should be just as invested in what you say to your employees
and
stakeholders.
Yeah.
And so all of that is encompassed in crisis planning and how you communicate in a crisis. And if you have a CEO or if you have someone someone in your organization that is going rogue on social media and saying crazy stuff about, you know, about minority groups or things like that, you should, one, turn their Twitter off. And then you should communicate to folks that companies are companies and companies have policies, and then people have opinions, and sometimes those are not necessarily the exact same. And so I think that there's real value. There's real shareholder value and real dollars and cents that are tied to reputation and ethics and how a company is viewed. And if you can't, and there are some things that you can manage, and you can manage how that, you know, that company's reputation is on social media. Social media can help you, and you can help, you know, the company's reputation in a bad situation by being honest with your employees and talking to them, because they're your first line of contact. There are tons of times on social media where everybody thinks that, you know, social media, everybody's out to get the big bad company, but there are tons of people that are willing to defend the brand just as much as there are people who are willing to, you know, denigrate it.
So now if you were working with a company and they don't have a crisis management, you know, a person that's in charge of that, or even a firm that they're working with, like, what's your counsel to get them kind of jumpstart their crisis management program?
Well, the first thing I think that they need to do is they need to look at their enterprise and see where the, you know, see where the risks are.
Where are the skeletons?
Yeah.
Well, kind of do a skeleton audit.
Yeah, they should, you know, a lot of times our engagements are, you know, we come in, we look at an enterprise and we say, you know, here's where the potential liabilities are, you know, for a crisis, you know, a communications crisis. And, you know, or we look at their overall crisis planning, and there are huge gaps in how they're going to communicate to those constituency groups once, you know, a crisis actually happens. And so we want to come in and we fill in those gaps for them and say, okay, you know, if something happens in one of your factories, you know, who's the first person you're going to call? Who's the person who's going to be the official spokesperson? How often are you going to update local media? If someone dies, who's going to be the person that makes that call? What are the protocols for that? We come in and we put that plan together for you, because, again, you don't want to be doing that stuff on the fly. It's just, you don't want to be doing that on the fly.
Well, you don't want to learn in that chaos. You don't want the learning curve to begin there.
Absolutely not. So we'll do an assessment. We'll help, you know, do the plans. We'll help, you know, do training. And, you know, those fire drills are great. You know, management teams learn a lot about their companies and themselves and, you know, their colleagues in those fire drills and those drills that we do. And
hey, you could do radio media training on Saturdays here at Business Radio X.
That's right. On the weekend, we'll come in and we'll ask them hard questions.
Yeah, if there's no coffee, you know, what happens to the guys when there's no coffee?
All right, so let's get your digits to Paula and everyone else out there, and particularly execs running organizations of any size and complexity that are going to have visibility and may have vulnerability. Let's get your digits, website, all that good stuff, Tom.
I work for William Mills Agency, www.williammills.com, williammills.com. And you can reach me on Twitter at Drew, Drew, McCaskill, McCaskill. You can pretty much Google us pretty easily. Crisis Communication or Andrew McCaskill or William Mills Agency.
Outstanding. We're going to leave your mic open in case I put my foot in my mouth.
And you jump in and rescue him.
you jump in and save me. You got to hang with us while we visit with our next
Absolutely.
Guest.
Absolutely.
Fantastic. Next up on Atlanta Business Radio, we have with us from CD Consulting Group, founder and president on board, Miss Constance Dierix. How you doing, sunshine?
I'm good. Thank you. This has been a blast so far.
Yeah? You learning anything over
there?
Oh,
absolutely. I think Andrew and I need to talk later because our work
There's a lot of crisis, it seems.
I hope not. I'm the only one, so I hope I'm not causing any crisis.
So give us a little bit of a feel, mission and purpose of your consulting practice and who you're out there trying to help.
Well, my clients call me the decision doctor. I'm an expert in decision making, including how you handle crises, by the way. And I help really outstanding leaders make bet-the-company decisions that lead to unprecedented results. So that happens in a variety of ways. I also have a particular interest and love for helping people grow and develop to the highest levels of an organization, if that's what they want to do. And in that vein, I am the president of Onboard, which is an advocacy group. We help women get on boards. We create awareness with public and private companies about the value women bring to business. Similar to what Andrew said, having women on a board is not a fluffy nice to have. It hits your bottom line hard. There's lots of research that shows that companies with more women on the board are more profitable, have better employee engagement scores, which is one of the predictors of financial performance. Again, it's not the fluffy stuff. And so we try to make that known And we do that by publishing a report every year. We've done it for 20 years. I have one in my hand, which, of course, your readers can't see, but you can see it. Please don't quiz me on all the details.
But what percentage of boards have women on it?
Well, in Georgia, public company board, there are 10.4% last year, and prior to that, there were 9.6.
And how many people are on a board typically?
Well, it depends on the type of company. Public company boards can have 10 or 12 people.
So that, there's only like one woman
there are
in,
a lot
in
of
the
boards,
room.
Right, right. That's very common. And
even
I,
though the customers, I would imagine, are it's not one out of 10
you
customers.
Know, we need
are
to
women.
Hire you to be a spokesman for us, because that's absolutely right. Your employees, your customers, your suppliers,
right.
Communities at large are not just it's men.
Right, but somehow the board is, you know, only one representative of women in there. That doesn't even make sense. Common
right.
sense.
Right. And in Georgia, until 2 years ago, about 18 months ago, there was still one Fortune 500 company. We have 13 Fortune 500 companies
here
based
in Georgia.
In Georgia.
Right.
One of them still did not have a woman on the board. And
Have they ever had a woman?
No.
And never in their history.
In private, we did a lot of arm twisting. It's not our intention to embarrass people in public, so we don't call them out in public. But in
well,
the
this is a good lead for
in
Andrew.
The report. Exactly. In the report. That absolutely. You have to think about your reputation.
Exactly. If you don't have a woman on your board now, that's pretty gutsy, I would think, right? I mean, that's
we love you. We would like you to be on our advocates list.
I mean, you're just
I'll
looking
talk
for
to you
trouble.
About it.
Yeah, but that's just yeah. the PR angle. Let's talk about real brass tacks, though. In my experience, and I think this is consistent with yours as well, women in general are smarter, they're more collaborative, and they're better with money. I mean, you really do need them on the board well beyond the PR angle.
My work here is done.
So how'd you get involved, and why are you so passionate about getting women on the board of more
Well, the
companies?
Origin of my passion is that in the late 80s, I was a stockbroker at Merrill Lynch.
Okay.
And it was an unfriendly environment for women. And there were three women in my office that were brokers. That was considered a lot. Like, they were afraid we were taking over because there were three
over.
Of us.
Wow.
And I experienced a very unpleasant work environment.
So you personally were affected?
I was. And it led me to get really curious about why that was happening.
Mm-hmm.
And I also, simultaneously, I was watching my clients make decisions about their money that I thought were just dumb. And they were pretty irrational. So I sat there and I thought, well, let's see. These people are not so rational, and these people are not so rational. So I quit my job and went back to school and got a doctorate in psychology.
All
just
right.
to question.
To understand.
To quell my own curiosity. I mean, that's a long time and a lot of money just because
right?
you're that curious.
Exactly. That's a commitment on your part.
That's okay. And my husband, so we have to, yay, Michael, who just had a birthday also. So.
I'm so glad that I didn't.
Glad we're able to bring that up again.
I didn't realize, I didn't do my homework like you're so good at doing that she had a doctorate in psychology. I would have been much more nervous about today's interview.
That's right. Well, I'm a recovering psychologist, so you're all right. You're not paying me, are you? Okay, then I'm not analyzing you. So I became, when I came out of graduate school, I started doing management consulting work. I have never been a psychotherapist, although I have that credential. And I help my clients make bet the company decisions, and I help them with things
like.
So
you actually encourage bet the company decisions?
Sure.
So bet the company decisions are
sure.
good.
Absolutely. If you're not making bet the company decisions, you're probably not growing.
How often should you make bet the company decisions?
Depends on your
daily.
Hopefully not daily. No.
Monthly, annually. I want to know because I have a partner here that likes to make bet the company decisions.
I'm very much in your camp. Believe me.
Okay. Yeah.
Of course, it's his money. It's just my company.
So about
I
how
think
often
you two do need my help? Actually, we'll talk later.
So, no, really, how often should you be considering bet the company decisions?
Well, I think it depends on the marketplace that you're in. When people say to me on an airplane, they say, what do? I say, I help clients achieve strategic congruence, to which people usually go, what?
Huh? Right. I got that.
You know, what is that? How do you do that? So what I've observed over almost 25 years of doing this is that organizations are getting better and better at understanding the external environment, their marketplace, which is critical to sustainable success.
Right.
What they have a harder time doing, and this is not a criticism, this is about being human, that they have a harder time aligning their organizations structurally, culturally, to take advantage and maximize the opportunity that they see in the marketplace. They might see it, but it's like looking through a glass pane. So I help them make the decisions that maximize that opportunity. So that includes, who should the leader be? Who should the CEO be? We're going to hire a new head of marketing. Help us do that. Our culture is too inward-facing. We're too insular. We need to be more market-facing. Help us do that. And I've done all of those things with clients. But it's very dependent on their particular situation.
And you work with the leader to at the highest levels in
yes.
order so that the decisions can be made.
Yes.
Right?
And one of the more frustrating places to work is actually in the boardroom. I have a video series on my website called Scenes from a Smoke-Filled Room, and it's actually I shot it on a green screen, but you know they put a boardroom behind me
right.
when we put them up on the site. And someone said to me, "Well, that's an old phrase. There's no smoke-filled rooms anymore." And I went, "Oh yeah, there are. There are." And it's people being human. You know, they get in a habit of doing something a certain way. They have their male professional colleagues in the boardroom with them.
And it becomes like an echo chamber, right?
It becomes like an echo chamber.
It's incestuous almost.
Right. And that's actually one reason I have a job. I'm glad you said that, because one client calls me his personal oxygen supply.
Mm-hmm.
He said, "You're the only one around here that when you come in, you're not blowing smoke up my pant leg." So that's a valuable thing.
Now, you have kind of a unique perspective on setting goals. Speak to that a little bit, because you've actually come out and said you think that can be a limiting thing.
Oh, yeah. I tell my clients all the time, the problem with goals is you might hit them.
That's a problem?
I mean, if an executive says to me, "Well, I don't know why we need you. We're growing at 8%. I say, how do you know it shouldn't be 12%? You know, why limit what you're thinking? Why limit the thinking of your people? And also, you know, one reason I do it is it's memorable, right?
Sure.
You're probably going to repeat that later.
I am going to repeat that.
Yeah, you have to give me credit.
He'll steal it. He's going to take credit for it.
Yeah, for a couple of days, I'll say, "Constance always says," right. And then a week from now, it'll be, "Like I always say."
Yeah, well, I stole it from Alan Weiss, so go right ahead.
So you mentioned Alan Weiss. Are you? Have you taken some of his classes?
Alan is a mentor to a number of people globally in management consulting. He works with a lot of solo practitioners and has written more books on management consulting than anyone in the history of business. And he's going to have to pay me for that advertisement. But I've known Alan for about 10 years, and I encourage people to participate in his workshops and to read his books.
You've gotten a lot out of it?
Yeah, I would estimate that my revenue is probably four times what it would be if I had never known Alan.
How's that for an endorsement?
No, I'm a big fan too.
Right. And part of my practice is coaching business owners mm-hmm. to help them grow their companies, and I have some stunning successes in that as well. Not as many as Alan, but you know, a lot of what I've learned about marketing and sales is pretty contrarian, and I've learned a lot of it from him.
Now, what are some of the challenges you see when an executive has to make these big decisions, and what are some of the mistakes they made, and what are some of the opportunities that are there if they would kind of look at it through maybe the lens that you help them look through?
Well, one of the mistakes they make, actually, probably Andrew can help them with, and that is that they think they can hide.
There's no hiding.
Yeah, Andrew's now back there, so you can yell on.
There's no crying in baseball. There's no hiding in business.
There's no hiding anywhere. So people think that they can keep something a secret. That's absolutely not true.
Right.
They think that they have time to do some. Well, you know, we don't. So one client said to me, "We need to do this succession work for the top. They're at risk because they don't have a successor for the CEO or either of the two EVPs that report to the CEO." And the CEO said, "Well, you know, I don't have budget to do this work." And I said, "You never have budget for this work. Doesn't mean you don't have the need."
And this guy
pays me to talk to him like that.
But that's a pivot in their own thinking, right? Because you're helping them prioritize. Everybody has budget. It's what you're deciding to spend it
on. Money is not a resource. It's a priority.
Right, so it's prioritizing.
Spending it on something.
Exactly.
Are you writing down some of these quotes, Kevin? We could have a book at the end of this thing.
No, it's my book. I mean, look around an office building like the one we're sitting in. It's beautiful. How much are they spending to water the plants, maintain the copiers? But if you're not spending money to have stellar leadership and a culture that's going to drive you to performance,
mm-hmm.
and you're sitting in an echo chamber because you don't want to hire your oxygen tank to show up, that's short-sighted.
Now, do you find that you're able to be this frank and straightforward when you initially meet with a prospective client?
Sure.
Good for you.
So you lead with this.
Sure, because why would I be someone else? You know, then they hire me and I show up and I talk like this and they go, wait a minute. you were really sweet fantastic. And we had tea and crumpets when you were here last time.
But how do you even wonderful. Get them to be open enough to and be vulnerable enough to say they have a problem to begin with?
That you use the right word, vulnerable. That's... I think a lot of what I do is teaching. I think of myself really as a teacher. And you have to be vulnerable to learn. You have to admit that you don't know what to do. So when I am first introduced to someone, and this is always by referral, it's always a connection of some sort, I have to decide if there's someone I can help. Not everyone who needs help can be helped.
Right.
And I don't want to spend my time in my professional life on people that just say, you know, it hurts when I do this, doc, and I say, well, stop doing that. I'm raising my arm for the listeners. Right. And they say, but I can't help it. And that's why I had to stop being a therapist. It was too frustrating.
So I want to take a look at this from the client's lens. And so let's take a prospective client that doesn't have the benefit of working with you, but they have another consultant in another specialty area that is very technically competent and would have a great deal to offer, but they're not as straightforward. And they're not willing to hit them between the eyes like you are. Mm-hmm. Help me as an executive get the most I can out of that consultant. Maybe it's an SEO consultant.
That's not a consultant. That's a contractor.
Okay. So, but
it's a pair of hands. I mean, it's valuable, but let's
help me
call it
manage,
what it is.
Okay. So help me manage that resource as if they were as strong as a Constance. What can I do to communicate? Look, I need you to work with me like Constance does.
Probably can't.
Just get another one until I find somebody that's a congruent fit.
I love how you pick up on the words.
But the chemistry is really important, I think. And I mean, to me, maybe it's individual.
No, she's saying choose wisely. That's what she's saying. Hire people that if you want somebody like her, then hire her like her.
But I want somebody like her in every domain.
Then wait it out until you find that person.
Right.
Well, I can certainly help people make selections. But there are a couple things that you can do to get better things out of people. Mm-hmm. One is you've got to focus your people on outcomes. There's way too much input and remedial work going on in organizations. Billions of dollars are spent on, let's say, you know, SAP implementations that get trashed. Mm-hmm. If they've spent $500 million, by the way, the CFO and CIO are probably also going to get fired.
Well, they get fired every, 24 months?
Yeah, reputation risk, which, by the way, is highly correlated with stock price. So, again, not talking about fluffy stuff here. But you have to be clear with people. I don't care how many hours you work. I asked you to fill this water bottle 6 months ago, and it's still empty. Bye-bye. Focus people on outcome. There's too much fascination with the shiny new toy. You know, we're going to have workshops on appreciative inquiry. Who cares? Are you getting the outcome that you want? So it's very similar to on board. This is why we measure how many women are on boards. And we're happy to talk to companies about that. But if you tell me you have a women's network and you're doing all these things, it may be nice. That's an input. We're looking for outcomes. And business owners, unwittingly, because they're people, they get a little bit sort of in the stew, and they start looking at inputs as though they're outcomes, and they don't realize they're doing. It's not that they're dumb. It's that they're human beings.
You had me at outcome.
Well, I think you're bailing. I think they're humans is a cop out. Like everybody's a human. I mean, that's the way it is. But if you want people, it sounds like you're saying effort is nice.
Yeah.
But outcome is what we got to be dealing with here.
Right.
Like we can't keep rewarding effort.
Right. And you can't do that on and on. So if, for example, one of the companies I'm working with right now, when I met with the executive to talk about what was going on, he talked to me for about 15 minutes. He was almost breathless. He just kept talking and talking because he's in a situation that's hard. And at the end of it, I said, it sounds like what you're saying is these people are just really uncalibrated. And he went, I think that's right. Say more. I said, well, they're insulated in a company that they've grown to this point that it's so successful that you bought it. But what they don't know is they don't know what other companies do. They don't know enough about the marketplace. They're having trouble adjusting. That got me hired. You know, that got me hired. Now I'm in the company, I'm working with them. If the executives who are humans, making human mistakes, can't change, then you have to change them out.
But what about...
It's not an excuse you get to have.
I know, but you see, when you
but
come...
But nobody's perfect.
Right, but when you come in there and say, look, it's all about outcome, it's all about outcome,
yeah.
Now are they holding you to that same standard? Like, you know, you're giving them that...
Not me, I'm not running the company.
I know, but they're hiring you to solve some problems.
Right.
You're not there just to, you know, give them a contrarian, devil's advocate point of view.
Actually, sometimes I am.
But then, so that's
an outcome.
So that's an outcome? Just giving, tell me the opposite of what I'm doing?
It might be. Well, only if I really believe it. Only if I really believe it.
Yeah, but you're going to be right a lot of the time, I think.
No, there's a service that I provide to some clients. It's an advisory service. And my clients pay me to have access to my brain, basically. They pay me a retainer, and we talk. Sometimes we talk a lot, sometimes we don't. And they pay me to tell them what I see because I'm the one that's going to, you know, they could fire me, but I still have a business. If a direct report of theirs gets fired, they have to go look for another job. So it's a different dynamic, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So, but some of the outcomes that I'm working on with this client, for example, are that I'm going to give them my professional opinion about how congruent their corporate culture is with their business strategy. That's valuable. We're going to know, are you lined up to succeed or are you not lined up to succeed?
Now, if somebody wants to learn more, website, how do they get a hold of you? Or you only work by referrals?
No, I'm happy to talk to people that call me. I actually got a call from a guy yesterday masquerading as a potential client. That happens a lot. He's a financial advisor. My husband's a CFP. You know, like I'm not hiring someone else. www.cdconsultinggrp.com.
Are you looking for more? Who do you want to be part of Onboard?
We want men and women that believe that the best way to run a successful company is to dip into the deepest and widest pool of talent. So that's www.onboardnow.org.
And then is this Onboard group, is that you meet regularly or do you just put out that document every year?
No, we have events that we hold every few months we have sellout crowds. We have an annual dinner that's coming up. It's going to be November 13th, and that's a big crowd. That's usually fun. Last year we announced our new name. We used to be known as the Board of Directors Network.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're on board. And one way people can participate is by joining our advocates list. You pay $250 to have your name on a list with really august people like Carol Tomei, Amy Whitley, who's the head of human resources for UPS. Happy to say she's also on our board. Becky Blaylock and people like that. So, you know, join an in crowd.
Now, would you guys be up to maybe coming on a regular rhythm to update what you guys are doing?
Absolutely. Sure. And I'd love to... have Jackie Parker join me next time. Jackie will be the incoming president of the Onboard Board in January. I have the honor of having that role until then. But Jackie is terrific. She's the president of the Newell Foundation and a real go-getter. Very impressive woman.
That'd make for a great segment. Yeah. We could do that periodically, right? Like on
sure.
I mean, I really want to support that cause because that
too.
Doesn't even make sense to me that it's
yeah,
that
no kidding.
Minimal.
I love your reaction. I wish I'd had a video camera on you. That was great.
I mean, I'm just
shocked. The look
shocked.
On your face was like,
I'm
what?
Like, I can't. It doesn't even, it doesn't make any sense to me.
Thank you for that. It doesn't make any sense to us either. It is changing, but the rate of change is so slow that it'll take way too long.
Right.
Well, thanks so much for coming this time, and I am so looking forward to having you back with some of the folks that you mentioned. Stay with us while we visit with our last guest,
okay.
Will you?
Sure.
All right, Lee, let's shed some light on the subject. We got our headliner now. He's been waiting patiently, taking notes, nodding. He's been very supportive. I don't know. He may have made a few funny faces during a couple of the segments, but we are delighted to have on the show from Next Generation Lighting, Mr. Tim Duff. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. Thanks, guys, for having us.
Oh, we are delighted to have you. What have you learned so far?
Well, it's been pretty interesting. I actually was focused so much on their conversations that I wasn't even paying attention to what I needed to say. So it was really good, really engaging. Good stuff.
That's why we have Andrew here to fix whatever
That's
you
right. He'll fix it. Yeah, don't worry about it. Kevin will fix some stuff in post, and Andrew will take it from there. LED lighting, though, that's your wheelhouse?
Yes.
Yeah, speak to that a little bit.
Well, I've been in the lighting industry for about 25 years, and so I've worked with large manufacturers, independent rep agency locally here in Atlanta for the last 10 years. But the progression of LED lighting over the last couple years has really changed the dynamic of lighting for commercial and residential, and is really going to change everything in the industry. So that's kind of where we're headed as a company.
Now, how is it going to change?
Well, if you look at the past, you know, with commercial lighting primarily is where we focus our time. The traditional sources like fluorescent lighting, which everybody has in their offices, you see some residentially. Those types of sources have been around a long time. LED really started several decades ago, but really is like indicator lights, background lights, not really useful lights to actually illuminate spaces. Mm-hmm. In the past 3 to 5 years, you've seen a real just exponential growth in how LED can actually light a space like we're in right now.
Now, is it more eco-friendly? Is there some? What are some of the benefits of switching?
Well, the benefits today, now that LED technology has progressed, is you actually get significantly longer life of your lamp. So a light fixture might last 4, 5, 10 times longer than what we traditionally have. So that's one piece of it. So if you're looking at a commercial application where somebody is sending in people to change out light bulbs on a regular basis, that's saving money right there.
Right.
Now, this is not LED lighting that we're under right now. Is that correct?
No, these are just traditional fluorescent lights that you'd see in 98% of American business.
So is it in 98% as traditional?
Wow.
Probably, yeah. People ask us all the time, how much LED lighting are you selling? Well, a lot of times when we're designing new facilities, we work with designers like engineers, architects, interior designers, and we may specify 40 to 50% of the buildings with LED lighting because of the technology. However, the higher cost initially is making people pull back.
That scares them away, right?
Yeah, so maybe 10% of what we're doing is LED, but we're kind of at this point that we think that in the next year or so, there's going to be a tidal wave of everything moving to LED. You know, and if you look at it, 5 years ago, we had our first LED fixtures that, hey, you can use LED to light up a little space, but it cost 5 times more, it lasted longer, saved a little energy, but it wasn't quite there. 2, 3 years ago, we finally got to the point where LED lighting gave the energy savings, a real payback, so you could talk to an owner and say, not only are we going to save you money on your energy bill, it's going to last longer, but now there's a payback for you, but people still have to realize there's a benefit to doing that. Well, now as we've gone through further, that delta between traditional sources and LED is getting smaller and smaller. So it's a lot easier to convince a client to do that.
Now, do they have to, if they switch to LED, they have to switch the whole guts of it too? You can't just switch to an LED bulb and it fits in your current situation?
Right. There's a couple different ways. On new construction, you can specify and use brand new LED fixtures.
Okay.
But fixtures like we're sitting in right now in most of the businesses, there's a retrofit kits that you can simply take out the old guts of the fixture, put in LED. In fact, if you go to our website, which is nextgenltg.com, we have a video on the front page, and you can see in about 5 to 10 minutes you can change it out to LED, which would take you down about 50 to 60% energy savings and something that lasts, you know, 2 to 3 times longer right away.
And so you could start collaborating with people like Mike Jenkins, and he could go in and say, wow, is that not LED lighting? Boy, this EMR stuff sure would run a lot better under LED, right?
You'd be able to see it a lot better.
You get better at it.
Right. Or you could
have everybody, we'll get everybody in here.
That's what happened to Paula. She suffered from fluorescent light. If she'd have been, there's all kinds of ways we could collaborate on this thing. So, but you put a lot of specific energy in marketing. You set up an agency to market this thing. Why now?
Well, it's interesting how lighting manufacturers go to business, and I probably spend more time trying to explain to neighbors and friends what we do for them to understand it. But large lighting manufacturers have independent reps in each territory or each market to sell in their market. So in Atlanta, just a few years ago, there were 7 lighting agencies that represented one major large line and then maybe 40, 50, 60 other supporting lines for what they do. What we do is we've taken on a line called Cree, which is the largest LED chip maker, but they're also the largest LED light fixture manufacturer in the industry. So as opposed to them being one of the supplementary lines to these big agencies, they've set a course to say we want to be a lead line since we're the biggest. So we're really the first agency that Cree set up in the country to focus just on Cree sales in the state of Georgia.
Now, your job is to get the word out to businesses that this is now is a good time to switch.
Yeah, and so, you know, we've already have a base of clients. So what we do is I call on architects and engineers and designers in the city to hopefully on new construction specify LED lighting and the other products that we represent. We represent other lines as well.
But the new constructions is the low-hanging fruit, right? Because they don't have to make any switches. They're just implementing a different fixture.
Well, yes and no. It's yes because there are new projects coming up all the time. However, when you go to a client who has an existing facility, you don't have to go through the whole process of getting it specified, going out to bid. Are they really going to do it? So a large part of ours is the energy savings business. So we talk to current clients to talk about changing out and upgrading their facilities. So we're really – it's about a 50-50 split on new construction and renovation.
And there's incentive around – haven't we had people in all of our studios that
are there tax
lead
breaks?
Certified are there... and tax breaks and all
yeah,
that
Yeah, there's
cool
a couple
stuff?
Different things. What's tough about Georgia and the reason why we're seeing a little less or a slower adoption to LED than we've seen in some of the other markets is we have cheap power here. I know it doesn't seem like that in the summer when you get your power bills. It doesn't seem real cheap when you get a $400 power bill. But power is cheap in Georgia. So when you talk to somebody in the Northeast or especially on the West Coast, California, where a lot of this has been driving, they have tremendous rebates. You put in a fixture, you get money back. And there are some rebates Georgia Power has offered at different times. There's also a national program called the Energy Policy Act where they will rebate you on your taxes based on basically energy savings in your space. So it gives you some incentives to be able to save. You can save up to 60 cents a square foot by energy savings. And that means a bunch of things, and LED is a big part of that. When you look at commercial businesses, approximately 40% of the power bill is lighting. So when you talk somebody...
Wow. Not air conditioning?
Nope. Now, in your home, it's much higher. And if you think about it, that's a majority of what we do.
Yeah.
But if 40% of your energy bill is lighting, and you can go in and tell someone we can save you 50%, right away you get their ear. However, just like all of us, if somebody tells you you can save this in your home, but it's going to cost you $5,000, if you don't have $5,000, you're not going to spend the money.
Now, when you're out there in the marketplace trying to get the word out, are you doing it through trade shows? Like, how do you go about going to market with this?
It's business-to-business contact. We go out and we work directly with the designers, calling them. You know, I worked for a factory for 13 years where we represented one large lighting line. But in the last 10 years, I've spent time just in Atlanta calling on design community. So now in this capacity, I'm able to go to the designers and say, hey, here's some things we have. Korea is the leading LED company, so now we have that, plus our other lines that we use to supplement that. We're also calling on electrical distributors, which is it's kind of like the commercial version of like a Home Depot, where we might go to a Home Depot to buy something we need for our house, but a commercial electrical contractor goes to an electrical distributor. Now, they are our frontline guys. They stock our products. They sell products to the community. So we work with them as well to help sell through into the marketplace.
Now, is your sweet spot like warehouses or industrial spaces?
Everything. And we work on offices, restaurants, warehouses, outdoor lighting. We pretty much call pretty much all commercial, a little bit of residential if it's multifamily, but primarily we're commercial and industrial.
Now, is the lighting better? Like, is it whiter or clearer, or is there some difference?
Just say yes.
I don't know. Like, can a person discern if
the answer to that's yes, right, Constance?
It's always yes.
Yes.
But is there how is it perceived to the person? Like, can they tell the difference if it's LED as opposed to fluorescent?
Yeah, and that's the big benefit that we've seen in the last literally 12 to 24 months. When LED first came out, just like any new technology, everybody ran out and said, oh, this is great. This is the new way. Everything's going to be LED. But what happened was you had a lot of failures. You had lighting that wasn't consistent, that didn't look very good. In fact, if a lot of people just think in their head, they think of LED as this white, blue light. It doesn't seem very comforting. But now you've got technology where lighting is so comfortable and warm to work under, you can use it in any environment and you wouldn't even tell the difference versus a traditional source. So and that's really been developed over the last year or two. We've got some large companies who won't look at LED because they got burned 3 or 4 years ago,
right,
so when the technology isn't even the same thing now.
So that's part of your challenge, right, to educate them. And do you have a way to demonstrate it?
Yeah, and that's something that we do. You know, we go out, we show products, we do demonstrations. What we do in a lot of cases, we're working with a large office space right now, and we took them a handful of fixtures to mock up in their space to look at it, evaluate it, let other people, clients look at it, and then they can decide what they want. So we do that on a regular basis.
Now, if somebody wanted to learn more, is there a website?
Yeah, our company's website is nextgenltg.com. So it's nextgenltg.com, and that's for our agency. We also have a link to Cree, which is cree.com, which links you to our main manufacturer and everything else that we have.
Yeah, but we want them to go to your website,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
so you
yeah,
get
yeah,
the credit.
And also, if you go to our website, under the contacts Dropbox, you can contact me directly. Just send us an email. You can also contact anyone in our company to learn a little bit more about it. But one of the big things that's helped us in terms of market initiatives is hardly anybody in here could name one lighting company other than something they buy a light bulb at the store. Well, Cree has been out promoting their new light bulb they have in the marketplace, and it's been on the British Open. It's been on the NBA Finals. You got billboards all around town. So it's been a real nice initiative. So we're getting a lot of
right, so people want to know more about it, and they got to go through you, right?
Yep.
All right, good stuff. Well, thank you, and thanks to all of our guests. This is Lee Cantor for Stone Payton. We will see you all next week on Atlanta Business Radio.